somebody left a watch here for me. They think that that's going to affect me. No, it won't work. I'm sorry. Well, I'll try. I just have to say something about economic democracy. Because now I said the situation of black people, demonstrates so clearly what democracy isn't and what it is. And the same thing is true of economic justice in this country, because there is no economic bill of rights. There's a political bill of rights, which itself has many problems, but there certainly is no economic bill of rights. There's nothing in the Constitution which says that an employer cannot work you 16 hours a day if that's the only job, that's the only place you can get a job. Really, there's nothing in the Constitution to say that you deserve health care or that you deserve a place to live, that your kids deserve to grow up having the same rights as everybody. Nothing in the Constitution to guarantee that. And so working people worked 12 and 14 hours a day, and they worked under terrible conditions, and they worked without any safety procedures, and they died by the thousands in accidents because, nothing to protect them. What did they do? They knew they had to do it themselves. They knew the branches of government would not do it for them. The president wasn't on their side. The courts weren't on their side. The police certainly weren't on their side. The National Guard and the Army, they were all brought out against them, but they stuck together. They organized. They went on strike. They faced off the police and the National Guard, and many of them were killed. There were massacres of working men that took place that are not mentioned in our history books, although every history book mentions the Boston Massacre, in which 5 people were killed. Really? No. The history books do not mention the massacres of working people that took place again and again in this country. Did you ever learn in your history courses about the Ludlow Massacre? How many of you know about the Ludlow Massacre? Oh, that's not bad. About 15 people.
We read your books.
Oh, okay. Anyway, I won't tell you about it. Read my book. Yeah, well, you think I'm just going to give you free information? No. Working people have always and still do, the people on this campus, right? People who work on this campus, and they work for minimum wage or close to minimum wage, the government is not going to protect them. Private, the people over them, the bureaucracy, the trustees, the administrators, they're not going to do it for them. They have to do it themselves. They have to organize themselves. They have to get the help of students. There has to be solidarity between people who work here and people who work there, people who work here and people study here. And then democracy comes alive,
In a way, Cornell, is a place where, that message has already been heard. I come here and I come onto the campus, and there are students demonstrating, for enforcement of the Kyoto Protocol. See, I guess they assume that, Cornell emits more noxious gases than U.S. Steel. I don't know what the rationale is, but there's something there. There is something there, you see. But at least, since the U.S. government is not going to do anything with the Kyoto Protocol, then citizens are going to have to do it themselves, piece by piece, place by place, really. Why not start in Ithaca? And I understand you have people here who are working against the prison system. for the system. Yeah. Talk about invisible people, you know. Really, really invisible people. These people locked away, put away. The things that are done behind prison doors, nobody knows about. Anybody who's been in jail, I won't ask for a show of hands, you see. But I'm sure there are people here. I can just tell that, you know, there are people here who've been in jail. I just see that criminal look on the faces here. But I've been in jail a few times, you know, 8, 9 times or so. We always brag about, you know, these things. Not for long. I was never in jail for long. Never wanted to stay in jail for long. 24 hours is enough. Well, that's all you need. You need a taste of jail, and it suddenly comes to you. It was all very abstract before. You just spend some time in jail, either behind bars yourself or visiting prisoners and going through that monstrous procedure which is required when you visit people in jail, and you realize that, these people may have committed crimes, may have committed crimes, maybe bad crimes, but that's one set of crimes. And then there's another set of crimes that is being committed against the people who are in prison. There's a double set of crimes going on. And I am a member of an organization which is started by a prisoner, a life, natural life. You know what a natural lifer is? Somebody who's in prison who cannot get out, no parole. Somebody who knows he's going to die in prison. And this is a guy I've been corresponding with for 15 years, Tio Atala Sala El. And he's an amazing, amazing person. You know, somebody committed a crime 25 years ago. You know, he's a totally, totally different person than the person who on that one day committed this crime. But he's in prison, and he knows he's going to die in prison. And so he does what he can. He forms a jazz band. He's a musician. He does all, and he organizes a national organization called the Coalition for the Abolition of Prisons. Anyway, it's here in New York, you know, you have lots of good institutions. You have Cornell. You have Sing Sing. You have Attica. Yeah, it's New York is a wonderful place. Yeah. And this is democracy coming alive. And it's important to know, I'm going to quit very soon, I swear. But and this is one of the things I learned. You realize I'm trying to give you the benefit of my wisdom? You see? One of the things I learned being involved in movements in the civil rights movement and the anti-war movement and so on and so forth. And a lot of you people have learned this too, that you mustn't despair because you're part of some little group. You know, it seems like it won't get anywhere. It seems like, how can we change national policy? But it has happened historically. Little groups have gotten together, and they don't know about the other little groups that are getting together in other parts of the country because they won't tell us what's going on. You know who I mean by they. You know, there is a they, you know, and they won't tell us what's going on in other parts of the country. But there are. The people are doing things all over the country, and that's how movements grow. That's how movements develop, out of little things that people do which seem hopeless. And then at a certain point in history, they come together. And you don't know when they'll come together. You don't even know if they're going to come together. But you know that if you don't do anything, nothing will come together. So you have to do every little bit you can. You see? You know. I want to end with a poem, because that's a good way to end. You can't miss with a poem. If you hear my words at the end, well, maybe they'll be okay, maybe not. But poets, they have it. And they can say things better than we can. Say. And also, you know what's encouraging? The poets of the world are on our side. You know, would you ever think of that? The poets, the artists, the theater people, the musicians, you know, right, they're, you know, Okay, now I'm encouraged to read two poems. One is by Edna St. Vincent Millay. It's called Conscientious Objector. I shall die, but that is all that I shall do for death. I hear him leading his horse out of the stall. I hear the clatter on the barn floor. He is in haste. He has business in Cuba, business in the Balkans, many calls to make this morning. But I will not hold the bridle while he cinches the girth, and he may mount by himself. I will not give him a leg up. Though he flick my shoulders with his whip, I will not tell him which way the fox ran. With his hoof on my breast, I will not tell him where the black boy hides in the swamp. I shall die, but that is all that I shall do for death. I am not on his payroll. Yeah. And and this poem is by a friend of mine. Of course, I claim all poets are friends of mine. But this, Daniel Berrigan. How do you know who Daniel Berrigan is? Yeah. Catholic priest, poet, taught here at Cornell. One time, we became friends when he and I traveled to North Vietnam together during the Vietnam War. We've been friends ever since. Amazing person, you know. Been to jail many times. That's a sign of a good person. Right? Wrote this poem in loving memory, Mitchell Snyder. Mitchell Snyder was an advocate for the homeless in Washington who became despondent and discouraged and killed himself. And Dan Berrigan wrote this poem in his memory. Some stood up once and sat down. Some walked a mile and walked away. Some stood up twice, then sat down. I've had it, they said. Some walked 2 miles, then walked away. It's too much, they cried. Some stood and stood and stood. They were taken for fools. They were taken for being taken in. Some walked and walked and walked. They walked the earth. They walked the waters. They walked the air. Why do you stand, they were asked, and why do you walk? Because of the children, they said, and because of the heart, and because of the bread. Because the cause is the heart's beat, and the children born, and the risen bread. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
You want another 2 hours?
Yeah.
We have time for a couple questions. We have two mics set up in the aisle. This first question can be here.
Mic isn't working. Is mic not live? Oh, there it is. Okay.
Hello? Okay. My question was, I wanted to know if you can tell, if you could tell us what type of human ingenuity could we have used to stop Hitler during World War II? And do you think that war in any case is justified, such as in humanitarian interventions? Do you think war is justified in any cases, such as in humanitarian intervention?
Did you all hear that?
Yes.
Okay. I was afraid you'd heard it. That's always the toughest question, you know, when you deal with war, because, you know, some wars are obviously stupid, you know, and but World War II, there's a, you know, this glow about World War II and Hitler and us, and I understand it, you know, it's complicated. After all, that's what led me, you know, so, you know, the just wars and unjust wars, I mean, that's the Orthodox creed. It's interesting, both the Catholic Church and the Communist Party have always believed in just wars and unjust wars. So it's very hard to break out of that thinking. Well, I remember a student of mine once wrote, in her paper, she wrote, wars are like wines. There are good years and bad years, good wars and bad wars, she said. But war is not like wine. War is like cyanide. One drop and you're dead. I thought this was pretty good. That's not an answer to your question, but you know, that's a way of evading an answer to your question, you see. But what ingenuity? Well, it's the hardest thing to, saying this in, you know, apology, in excuse and so on, for inadequacy, but it's true that when something has happened in a certain way, when a certain scenario has played itself out in history a certain way, it is very hard to imagine it happening any other way. And so once, you know, you go through the war and once Hitler is defeated and victory, it's very hard to imagine that fascism could have been resisted some other way. And yet, you know, and if you posit the possibility there might be other ways to deal with fascism than a war, massive war of indiscriminate killing in which, you know, 50 million people are killed, and most of them, innocent people, have nothing to do with Hitler and fascism and this and that. But once, you know, you have to deal with that, it's very difficult, you know, to persuade people, you know, that there's other scenario. And what I'm saying is we have to begin to think that way. You have to think. Now, could there be another scenario? Well, could Hitler have been resisted not by massive war against city populations and so on, but by underground resistance and disobedience and non-compliance? Could there have been using time and let his empire extend and extend and extend in the way empires extend and then reach their limits and then begin to falter and fall apart? We don't know. And I'm not saying I know positively that this could have been done. All I'm saying is there are times when you don't know really exactly what to do about a complicated situation, but you know what you must not do. And I know that the thing not to do is to kill huge numbers of people on behalf of any cause, because while the killing that you do is immediate and certain, the cause that you're working for, the end that you're working for, is always uncertain. You don't know what's going to happen at the end of that, after that certain expenditure. In other words, the evil means are certain. The end is uncertain. So all that I'm suggesting is that this is the great challenge for humankind in our time. The great challenge is to use that, yes, that imagination ingenuity that has given us technological wonders and figure out ways of resistance to evil and aggression and tyranny which do not make things worse, which do not involve the indiscriminate killing of large numbers of people. So humanitarian intervention? Well, if you can show me an intervention which does not make things worse than before, well, maybe we'll grant the possibility, you see. But you take a look at our latest humanitarian intervention in Kosovo. Read Noam Chomsky. Really. He wrote... He wrote a little book called, I think it's called The New Military Humanism or something like that. Is that the name of it?
Yes.
Hmm?
Yes.
That is the name of it, sure. Because I don't want him to think I got the title of his book wrong, you see. The New Military. But he writes, you know, he does his research very, very carefully. And he writes about what we did in Kosovo. But even before he wrote, it was clear, because our own commanders, military commanders are saying this, you know, after we intervened, presumably for humanitarian reasons, more people were killed than had been, you know, than were victims before. More refugees by far were evicted from their homes than had been evicted before. And in general, when you engage in military intervention for presumably humanitarian reasons, you generally make things worse, you know. I don't want to be, you know, an absolutist and say maybe there's some situation in which some small, you know, act, you know, will prevent some large evil where there's a certainty of, maybe. But you have to think also of this, that the interventions are organized by people who cannot be trusted. The governments cannot be trusted, because the truth is, these governments do not have humanitarian aims when they intervene, whatever they say. They didn't have humanitarian aims in World War II. There were humanitarian issues involved, the Jews and the, you know, and so many people are victims, but the great powers did not have humanitarian aims in World War II. And the governments do not have such aims. So you have to take that as one of the factors into consideration when you think, well, there's a possibility of humanitarian wars. Well, we'll go to this microphone.
Hi. I was researching a chronology recently, and I came across on the web that after the Civil Rights Act, there was the Voters' Rights Act, and that meant that every 20 years, the president would have to renew the Voters' Rights Act. Is that correct? So Reagan was the last person to sign on to this, and that means that, quote unquote, African Americans can't technically vote unless the president
it's going to come up again.
Signs on to that.
Yeah, the
is
Voting Rights Act is going to come up again, and it's always in danger. You can't just give blanket right to vote to people, you know, forever. You have to reconsider. It's yes.
I'm aware that all of us, all the time, are contributing to the system of inequality just by living in the society, by going to school, by driving our cars, by having jobs, buying clothes, buying food, etc. We're all contributing to the system, but it's hard to break out of the system, and because we're all so intimately entangled in the system. And so it seems that the only way we can challenge the system of inequality is by working from the inside out. And I was just wondering if you could give us some suggestions for basic and realistic and everyday steps we can take to combat capitalism and to further democracy.
What did you say?
Huh?
Yeah. This is Ithaca. You don't need me to answer that question. Hey, just look around, just at your own life, the space around you, and see what can I do. You say, And there's always something you can do. There's somebody you can help. There's something you can protest, something, some group you could join, and so on. And obviously, people here have lots of ideas. Yes.
The Summit of the Americas is fast approaching in Quebec City. The Summit of the Americas, can you hear me now? Okay. The Summit of the Americas is fast approaching in Quebec City. And so I have two questions. One is, what are you thinking about leading up to the summit? And the other is, what's the historical context for this kind of dissent, the kind of dissent that moves across national borders? Has this happened before in the Western Hemisphere?
Well, I mean, to ask me what I think about it, I'm thinking about it the way you're thinking about it, you know, right? And you know, this is, you know, they're the big financial moguls, and they're in charge, and they're making decisions that affect the lives of people there and the lives of people here, and something has to be done about it. And what's happening in Quebec is an example of it. And you're asking, well, have been other examples like this, crossing national lines? Not like this, really. You know, I'm sure there've been times of international solidarity, and you know, during the Spanish Civil War, right? The people in this country supporting the anti-fascist forces in Spain, and you know, always things going, there've always been kinds of solidarity. You know, back in the 1880s, the International Working Men's Association, working people in Chicago and New York and working people in Europe. But this is really a new situation of, you know, the financial wizards of the world taking charge and people trying to forge ties with people in other nations. You know, there was some attempt to do that during the debate in Congress over the North, you know, the NAFTA, you know, North American Free Trade Agreement, and there were some ties created between Mexican trade unions and American trade unions, but that's the future, the future of organization against the financial control of the world by these people. The future lies in the crossing of borders, and in Brazil recently, right? There's gathering of 10,000 people in opposition, you know, as a counterpoint to what was going on in Davos, Switzerland, you know, where the financial leaders were meeting, and people from countries all over the world were meeting in Brazil. And there have been meetings in the last 5-10 years of representatives of NGOs, of non-governmental organizations, in various parts of the world, you know. So I feel that this is growing, the idea of internationalism, of hands across borders, is growing, and it's absolutely, you know, necessary.
Hi, Professor Zinn. My name is Jesse. I'm from the Spartacus Youth Club.
Yeah.
And so, as you pointed out, the rulers of this country are typically use the rhetoric of democracy in support of their own goals, whether they be unsavory or not. One important time when this was the case was in their drive to destroy the Soviet Union in the 80s and 90s. Only in this case, a lot of so-called leftists jumped on board with them. For instance, Professor Noam Chomsky and yourself. In a Z Magazine interview, you said, quote, that you were very glad with the disintegration of the Soviet Union that you could no longer associate the Soviet Union and socialism. You could no longer say this is a place where socialism existed.
Right.
Well, that's undeniable, because with the capitalist counter-revolution in the Soviet Union and East Europe, you had a return of mass unemployment, homelessness, bloody national warfare, and internationally, it meant the increase in imperialist rivalries, increased imperialist rivalries and the ability for the U.S. to ride roughshod over the world, including Iraq and Yugoslavia. So my question for you is, my question is, today, this isn't just an abstract question for historians. Today, the exact same question is posed with China. So my question is, do you say that the Chinese economy is worth giving military defense to, or would you support...
Do I say the Chinese economy is what?
Do you defend China against imperialist aggression? Would you defend it? Would you defend it, or would you say that it's a victory of the human spirit, like capitalist counter-revolution was in the Soviet Union? That's what I'm asking.
Well, let me see if I can boil down your question, although you may object to the way I'm boiling it down, you know? But I thought you were saying, well, Noam Chomsky and I and some other so-called lefties, you know, southpaws, whatever we are, and that we sort of said, when the Soviet Union fell apart, we said, this is an occasion for socialism to become separated, the idea of socialism to become separated from the Soviet Union. Yes, I said it. There's a hush in the audience. When you hear a confession, people are hushed. But I said it, and I believe it. I thought the Soviet Union was not a good example of socialism. Really, I thought it was not a good example of socialism. And so, to put it another way, I grew up believing in socialism. I read, you know, Eugene Debs, Emma Goldman, Helen Keller, Jack London, Clarence Darrow, these were heroes. Upton Sinclair, these were heroes. Socialism was a noble thing, and, you know, equality and, you know, well, I won't go into all the rest. But yes, Soviet Union gave socialism a bad name, to put it bluntly. You know, you're going to attach socialism to a dictatorship and to the execution of people and the suppression of free speech. No, that's not socialism that was my ideal when I was growing up. And it, as I said, it gave socialism a bad name. It meant that any time you declared yourself a socialist, you believe in Stalin. So I thought that, yes, it's good that the Soviet Union no longer stands for socialism. It's not good, and here I agree with you, it's not good that the disintegration of the Soviet Union was accompanied then by, you know, capitalism moving in and taking over and saying, now we're going to make over the Russia in our image, bad, what has been done there, you know. And I'm hopeful that out of this turmoil in the Soviet Union, you know, that something new will arise, which will be a real democratic socialism, just as I hope out of the turmoil in this country that a democratic socialism will arise. But, you know. Yeah.
A little related to somebody's last comments, I would ask you, Tocqueville, 170 years ago, said that it's so hard for dissenters to go anywhere in this country, and it's still difficult. My question is, why is it so hard to penetrate the majority of thought in this country?
The majority?
Of thought in this country, yeah. They just don't understand or don't let any kind of dissent in. How can the American people be manipulated so easily with their majority of thought that most people accept? How did they get away with that so easily in this country? You just saw some examples of this. What we told to believe.
Hmm? Am I right in understanding your question? How come
people think the way they do badly?
In large majorities, and can't be moved.
How is it that they're so easily deceived? And, well, no. Yes, people are deceived in so many ways, you know. But it's not hard to understand why. It's not because they're stupid. It's because people act and think on the basis of the information that's given to them. And the information that's given to people is given to them by, you know, Time Magazine and Newsweek and CBS and NBC and, you know, and television and all of, you know. And so it's not at all surprising that people... What is surprising is that despite all of that, there's a certain basic common sense in people that comes through. For instance, when they do they've been doing surveys for many years now about public opinion, and if you look closely at these public opinion surveys, there's a question that they ask again and again, and the question is, do you think a small number of people control this country? And 80% answer, yes. Yeah. Then, you know, it all depends on the kind of question. You know how in polls, so much depends on the kind of question you ask. And depending on the question you ask and then the answer, which is almost made inevitable by the question, you can get a distorted notion of what people think. People think complicatedly. Because if you ask those same people who said a small number of people run this cable, do you think we have a democratic country? I would guess most of them would say yes. Obviously, those two answers don't jibe, right? Now, they ask people, do you think we should do something about welfare? You think welfare should be reformed? Well, the papers were carrying on a barrage, and the politicians carrying on a barrage. Welfare, welfare, right? We've got to reform welfare, you know, and so on. And so the word welfare became a bad word. And but when they asked people, and my mind goes back to a very specific New York Times issue right after the Republican congressional victory in 1994. You know, 2 years after Clinton was elected, the Republicans won big in Congress. And the New York Times headline said, "Public supports Republican ideas." You know. And then inside, there was a poll of people. And they asked people, do you think the government should help people in need? 65%, yes. When they took polls of people before the health issue became absolutely confused with Clinton's ridiculous health plan and all these other things, and they asked people, do you believe that we should take the Canadian system or the single-payer system? 60% or so of the Americans answered yes. The public opinion on the matter of reducing armaments, public opinion has always shown that the public has always been much more in favor of reducing the military budget than both Republican and Democratic parties. I guess what I'm saying, when people eat this, what's amazing to me is that people still have a certain basic common sense idea, even with all these attempts to, you take capital punishment. When the politicians again and again and again insist on the importance of capital punishment and so on, and the media doesn't counter that with evidence and educate the public, the public then goes along. But they found this in studies, that when people are given more information about capital punishment, we're given more information about the failure of deterrence, more information about innocent people put to death and so on, then the figures drastically decline on how many people support capital punishment. So I'm saying that yes, you can despair about how people are brainwashed and so on, but you have to think that's our responsibility. No, we have a responsibility to, because when people learn, when people are informed, they act. When people at the beginning of the Vietnam War were given, wow, they've attacked us in the Gulf of Tonkin. People didn't even know where the Gulf of Tonkin was, right? Thought it was off the coast of San Francisco, you know, maybe New Jersey, who knows? You know, Gulf of Tonkin, imagine. When people learned what was happening in Vietnam, you know, at first there was a barrage of propaganda, democracy, liberty, support the South Vietnamese, now down with the communists and so on. But when people learned about what was going on in Vietnam, we had a great anti-war movement despite all of that. So, yeah, we mustn't give up on the fundamental common sense instincts, decent instincts of people, I think. Which mic are we using now? Yours.
My name is Jared Ball, and I'm a graduate student at the Africana Studies and Research Center, and I just want to thank you for coming. You've been a great inspiration to me personally as an up-and-coming historian, and I appreciate your time. And for those listening, Professor Zinn has spoken about the free market of ideas and how that does not exist, and I would hope everybody here would take the time to involve themselves in the movement to endow Africana, as it stands as a lone bastion on this campus for keeping those ideas free. There were a lot of things I would like to have asked, but I'll stick with some very simple ones. You had mentioned that as you were developing your own understanding of history, you had read several black scholars whose names were left off your reading list, and I'd like if you wouldn't mind just listing some of those for the audience. And also, during the introduction it was mentioned about the switch to black power, SNCC's moves to black power, somewhere around 1966, and how that had affected you and your efforts. And I'd like for you to speak on that and what you thought of it and what you think of it today. And just for the question that was sent a few seconds ago, the late, great Kwame Ture said, you don't judge socialism by socialists, just as you don't judge Christianity by Christians. And since his legacy is still with us, and he was one of the founders and great leaders of SNCC, I'd like for you to just speak on, what you thought of black power and the black scholars that influenced you.
Did you all hear that? Okay. Well, first, I want to know I talked about black scholars that weren't on my reading list, right? Yeah. Well, even Du Bois, right? I mean, talk about black scholars. Even Du Bois was not there. You know, a black Reconstruction. There were a whole bunch of books on Reconstruction. The Du Bois classic Black Reconstruction was not on the list. Franklin Frazier, great black sociologist. You know, nowhere there. On the list. John Hope Franklin was not on the list. Rayford Logan, when I was living in the South, teaching in a black college, and I began to read black historians, and I came across Rayford Logan. Remember I said something about the progressive period in American history? Rayford Logan wrote a book about that period. And it was then that I realized, wow, this is the period that I always knew as the progressive period, and yet, and of course there's the Journal of Negro History, and people like Lawrence Reddick writing for it. There's great black historians and other scholars. Those are some of them. Then on this other question, black power, my reaction to it, let's put it this way. I understood it, you see, and it meant different things. There are many different elements to black power. And part of it was there were things which were sort of immediately understandable, and that is the fact that the civil rights movement had achieved certain victories, the legal segregation eliminated in the South and so on, the Voting Rights Act and so on. Certain victories had been won, but the black power movement recognized that that didn't touch the roots of racism and exploitation of black people in this country. And so theirs was a more militant and more radical critique of society, and Malcolm X represented it best, you see. Although also towards the end of his life, Martin Luther King understood that the next step
for the civil rights movement had to be dealing with economic injustice, with poverty. And that's what he was engaged in the several years before he was killed. You know, and just as he was killed, he was supporting the strikers in Memphis. And so Black Power had, you know, was a sort of recognition of the limits of the civil rights movement and the need to go beyond it. Not everything that Black Power stood for or believed in, you know, could speak to me, right? But and the idea of segregation, or the, you know, well, there's a tricky business, because it's also true that the simple idea of racial integration was, in itself, was not a solution, even though segregation was not a solution. But the idea that everything will be solved by so-called racial integration was obviously not working. And so I could understand that the separatism that was connected with Black Power. And I felt that it was maybe a kind of necessary stage in the development of Black militancy to separate themselves and organize themselves by themselves before doing what I thought ultimately would be necessary, and that is create, you know, a rainbow coalition of Black, white, across the spectrum, a unified movement against the American establishment.
That was historian Howard Zinn speaking at Cornell University on April 12th. Zinn is the author of several works, including A People's History of the United States, which focuses on history from the perspective of the lives of the common people as opposed to presidents and generals. As Howard Zinn reiterated during the talk we just heard, any democratic advances in this country have come as a result of organized mass movements. The press has played a role in building movements throughout history. Tom Paine's pamphlets were instrumental in advancing the cause of the American Revolution, and abolitionist newspapers were pivotal in mustering support for the movement to end slavery. At this time, when the forces of wealth and privilege are vigorously working to undermine democracy wherever it crops up, the media is mostly silent on this issue. This is because most of the independent media has been eradicated or subsumed into corporate conglomerates. These corporate conglomerates are benefiting directly from the undemocratic trends in our society, and they consciously avoid providing information that would serve the organization of mass movements against corporate domination and capitalism. Radio has been the hardest hit. Media activists have called for a boycott to focus on Clear Channel Communications, which boasts that it owns 1 out of every 10 radio stations in the United States, which is more than 1,000 radio stations. We're going to hear a couple of reports concerning Clear Channel. One on an April 26th protest and boycott to break the Clear Channel media empire, and also about the corrupt government connections that protect and advance its spread.
Do you remember the days when local radio was really local? When there was an actual live DJ in the studio? Do you remember when there was more than 2 or 3 companies that owned radio stations in your market? Well, those days, sadly, are long gone. With corporations like Clear Channel Communications leading the way in how to kill local radio, the listening public is falling victim to manipulation and deception motivated by personal greed. Clear Channel Communications boasts being the largest radio group owner in the United States. They are responsible for such hate-infested programming like Rush Limbaugh and Dr. Laura, two exceedingly right-wing syndicated talk show hosts. The darker side of Clear Channel Communications is more than public deception and right-wing propaganda. It's much more disturbing and offensive. From mutilation, torture, harassment, and hostile working environments to actual deaths, Clear Channel has a lot of blood on its hands. Here are 6 examples of why you should boycott Clear Channel Communications and their advertisers. February 27, 2001. WXTB disc jockey Todd Klim, also known as Bubba the Love Sponge, and his producer Lee Hatley were charged with felony animal cruelty for the torture and killing of a boar in the radio station's parking lot live on the air. February 23, 2001. Former KYLD DJ Joe Lopez received a jail sentence for a stunt pulled in the previous year. Lopez and an intern for the San Francisco station dressed up as convicts and harassed a Bay Area neighborhood pretending to be escaped prisoners as a station prank. The two were arrested for misdemeanor charges of inciting a false emergency. Neighbors of the area have filed suits against the station for this act of harassment. June 13, 2000, WMRV, FM Star 105.7. A hoax turned deadly when a woman who was there with her family under the pretense that pop star Britney Spears was making an appearance at the station collapsed during the excitement and later died. The promotion was a hoax, featuring a look-alike model complete with limousine. June 2000, KBPI Denver disc jockey Willie B. incites hundreds of 4x4 fans to tear up Rocky Mountain wetland habitats with an illegal mud fest. February 3rd of 2000, same station in Denver, KBPI is investigated for animal cruelty after the same DJ, Willie B., dropped a live chicken off of a building on the air and cited listeners to bring animals to an interstate and see how many make it across the highway. December 3rd, 1999. Three tower workers were killed while working on WFMX antenna. Two of the victims were teenagers. The fall occurred due to outdated equipment that wasn't considered safe by current industry standards. Clear Channel had outsourced the antenna service, most likely without proper consideration or research into the safety practices of that contractor. Not only does Clear Channel engage in these types of marketing and promotions, it tricks its listeners into thinking their local radio station is actually local. More and more stations are cutting programming staff. In many markets, sister clusters are taking on more work providing voice tracking for smaller sister stations. At these smaller clusters, there may be only one live person in the complex for 5 to 6 different stations. That means there is a staff ratio of 1 to 6, where prior to 1996, the ratio was 1 to 1 for staffing stations. Management at the cluster level has its share of secrets and skeletons as well. Unfair hiring practices, lack of workplace safety, hostile working environments, allowing sexual harassment abusers to retain their jobs while terminating others. This is just some of the sick and twisted behavior that is consistent with Clear Channel Communications. Your local radio stations owned by Clear Channel, which bring in advertising money from your local businesses, does not stay in your local economy. It all gets funneled out of state to Texas and Wall Street. Is this the type of radio company you want in your local community? If not, go to their advertisers and explain to them that they are supporting a corporation that commits heinous acts against the environment, animals, and humans. Tell the business that you cannot support them if they continue to support a corporation that condones and promotes these types of activities and behaviors. You can help make a difference in your community today by boycotting Clear Channel Communications radio and television stations and their advertisers. Here's a Party Town streaming special report on nepotism, family ties in media, and politics. It seems as though the millennium is turning into the age of nepotism. From the White House to Clear Channel Communications, one can draw a family triangle of sorts, tying top government officials with top media ownerships. For example, we have been forced to accept a second generation of Bush in the White House, whose brother was coincidentally involved with the election controversy as governor of Florida. While President Bush now resides in Washington, D.C., the nepotism continues, linking him with the largest commercial radio station group owner, Clear Channel Communications, out of Texas. The link between Bush and Clear Channel exists between the deal that was made when Bush sold his interest in the professional baseball team, the Texas Rangers, to Tom Hicks, then CEO of AM/FM Communications. Tom Hicks of the leveraged buyout firm Hicks, Muse, Tate, and First has had substantial interests in the radio broadcast industry. After the Telecommunications Act of 1996, Hicks combined radio companies Chancellor Media with his brother Steve Hicks, Capstar Broadcasting, forming AM/FM, which was then acquired by Clear Channel Communications, bringing in the Mays family. Lowry Mays, the patriarch, is CEO of Clear Channel. His two sons, Mike and Randy, are also closely tied in as chief operating officer and chief financial officer. Clear Channel has engulfed nearly 70 separate radio groups across the United States since 1996. While on the campaign trail last year, FCC Commissioner Michael Powell, along with his infamous father, General Colin Powell, were being prepped for top offices under the hopeful Bush administration. The FCC chairman appointment to Powell was less than surprising after the ultimate outcome of the selection of our current president. One of the first big issues that Commissioner Powell had to face was the largest communications merger in history, the AOL Time Warner nuptials. What the general public was shielded from, thanks to the relationship of politics and corporate broadcasters, was the fact that General Colin Powell was on the board of directors for AOL, and subsequently was profiting from millions of dollars of AOL stock options. Upon doing a search on SEC filings by General Powell, we found that he also owned stock in Time Warner prior to the merger. Commissioner Powell did not exclude himself from the FCC approval, citing there was no basis to a quote-unquote fuzzy connection between himself and AOL. The FCC has been quick in acting upon corporate media mergers, yet slow in acting when it comes to the public needs and trust. The Hicks, Mays, Powells, and Bushes are all part of our corporate-dominated landscape of nepotism. It's a family orgy of wheeling and dealing, trading and influence in order to benefit their personal interests. It's corporate political control, a wilding entanglement of special interests and backdoor favors of the power elite. With the media under control of corporate and political interests, it's no wonder something like the 2000 election fiasco occurred. A theatrical display of choreographed moves by the media shaped a staged future for America, to which the extreme right wing can manipulate it at will. Family ties like these are not unlike those which are portrayed as mafia-like, but of a higher echelon. Our current administration is extremely friendly with the large corporate media families, for they all have something to gain from one another. That's at the expense of the trust and integrity of the American public.
Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Unwelcome Guests is produced by Chris Sturr, Jesse Lind, Lynn Gary, and Sean Ewald. We are solely responsible for its content. Like an unwelcome.